Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, I-17 northbound, an accident blocks the shoulder at 7th Avenue. And on the 202 eastbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident on the exit ramp at 32nd Street. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon, a forecast high of 91 degrees. Clear tonight, overnight lows near 60. Sunny skies, 84 degrees at KJZZ.
Following another lengthy debate Wednesday night on how the Phoenix City Council should begin its meetings with or without verbal prayers, a majority of members pulled a 180 of sorts. Here's Councilman Jim Waring.
We brought in our own experts, and it went pretty well. Three members changed their votes, so it was a 7-2 vote to reinstate prayer.
KJZZ's Christina Estes was at the meeting and is with me now. Christina, after this back-and-forth battle, what did the council ultimately decide?
Well, they voted to reinstate spoken prayer at the start of council meetings using a limited group. The public invocation would have to be led by a chaplain from the Phoenix Police or Fire Departments. It would replace the current moment of silent prayer and reflection.
So this was not an overnight success. How did we get here?
Well, the council had to address a citizen petition calling for public prayer to be restored, and that's what led to last night's action. But the issue really started last month. That's when members of the Satanic Temple were scheduled to give the prayer. But before that could happen, the council voted to replace the spoken prayer with a moment of silent prayer and reflection.
Now, we remember that night got pretty heated. What was the discussion like last night?
It was deja vu. Long and heated, and at times it seemed to get pretty personal. You have four council members who've been very vocal about trying to find a way to bring back the spoken prayer. Other members said they wanted people to be able to pray, but they also needed to be fair and open to everyone. And then Mayor Stanton said the silent moment seemed to strike a good balance and should stay. One of the more colorful comments came shortly before they voted. That's when Councilwoman Thelda Williams said the issue has become a political football. She said she was going to vote for the spoken prayer by chaplains because it was time to end it. She said Phoenix is, quote, above this crap, quite frankly.
Okay, so since we're above the crap, what next?
City staff must determine which chaplains are willing to lead prayers and also how to handle maybe a potential legal challenge. To return to spoken prayer requires a change in city ordinance, and the council is expected to vote on that later this month.
KJZZ's Christina Estes on the Phoenix City Council and prayer. Christina, thanks.
Thank you.
Arizona's Department of Economic Security has grabbed some uncomfortable headlines lately. Last week, the job status of two DES employees was affected by the discovery that an 86-year-old woman related to one of the workers had been padlocked inside a Mesa house. At least three others who work in adult protective services for DES are also facing discipline. This comes just as DES Director Tim Jeffries marks 1 year on the job, and he joins me now. Tim, what do these situations tell us about this job and how you've tried to go about changing how it's done?
Arizonans, be it the ones we serve, the ones that fund us, maybe even the ones that don't know we exist, deserve an agency, a social services agency that has impeccable values, dare I say virtues. So when we have colleagues that violate these values, regardless of the circumstances, there's either verbal coaching, written coaching, or decisive exit.
How important is it that when you act decisively, as you have, that it is made public, that people can know about it? Is that important so that there is that concrete example of, yes, you are making changes, they're not just words, and people can actually find out what it is you're doing?
More than ever, Americans distrust government. And one of the reasons they distrust government is because they don't believe government is truthful with them. They don't believe government is transparent with them. They believe that government just wants to give them good news and doesn't have the spine to give bad news. I operate in a wide open, highly transparent way. If we terminate a DES colleague because that DES colleague has submitted her mother-in-law to unfathomable and egregious living circumstances, then the public needs to know that. If we terminate a colleague for not only stealing, but stealing from the poor, which is what happens when a colleague in our benefit group steals. Stealing's illegal. Stealing from the poor is a special kind of bad. So when we terminate the colleague, we precede that termination with an arrest. And the public needs to know that.
Have you, through the first year of this position, have you been able to work with employees, with colleagues, however we should phrase that, who are dedicated to the job, and let's say do it well, but are not passionate in the same way you are? Does that rub you okay?
It's a wonderful question. You know, thankfully, my friend, not everyone is as passionate and as gregarious as I am, because that would be exhausting for everyone if that was the case. But what I've found as I've crisscrossed the state, I've visited 85 of our 121 offices. So I've literally been in front of well north of 6,000 of our 7,000 plus. And what I've been blessed to see is thousands upon thousands of beautiful public servants, thousands upon thousands of what I feel are the heroes of Arizona, the very best citizens we have, because maybe they started DES to have a job, ply their craft, but they don't stay here for years upon years because of the money. They stay here because the work matters. I'm pleased to report to you, although there have been numerous exits while I've been the director, it's only been 3-4% of the workforce, and that's very small.
Department of Economic Security Director Tim Jeffries.
It's the show on KJZZ for Thursday, March 3rd. I'm Mark Brody.
And along with the takeaway is John Hockenberry. I'm Steve Goldstein. Well, from Super Tuesday to Bloody Thursday, we're watching as the Republican Party is trying to take down its own frontrunner with an all-hands-on-deck political sacrifice. Is there a doctor in the House? Well, not anymore. Ben Carson is out of the race as of today and probably relieved at this point.
Mitt Romney gave a speech today tearing apart every aspect of Donald Trump's record and grasp of national affairs. And Donald Trump, shimmering with his recently acquired Super Tuesday credentials, responded to Romney at a political rally in Maine a few hours later.
Let's start with Romney, though. Evoking the gods of American conservatism, the failed 2012 presidential candidate went after Donald Trump's character, his business acumen and morality, his truthfulness, and even whether he has any intelligence. For the anti-abortion Republican Conservative Party, this was a public attempt to abort Donald Trump's aims at the Republican nomination 9 months before Election Day. Listen, here's Romney assailing Trump's business sense.
His bankruptcies have crushed small businesses and the men and women who work for them. He inherited his business. He didn't create it. And whatever happened to Trump Airlines? How about Trump University? And then there's Trump Magazine and Trump Vodka and Trump Steaks and Trump Mortgage. A business genius he is not.
Romney also called him a liar and a fraud, profane and repugnant morally. This was the same person who Romney was happy to have endorsing him back in 2012 when Romney said that Trump's business instincts were exactly what the country needed. But speaking today, Romney said for Trump to get anywhere near the White House would be an instant global crisis.
He's not of the temperament of the kind of stable, thoughtful person we need as leader. His imagination must not be married to real power.
Kimberly Lobey of Willoughby, Ohio, voted for Mitt Romney in 2012, and we got her immediate impressions of Romney's attempted Trump takedown speech.
I have to say that I wonder if what he did will only serve to strengthen Trump's position, because most of the people voting for Trump at this point are bucking establishment politics, and that's how they're looking at Romney. He almost came off as a little bit of a bully, insulting the intelligence of the people that are backing Trump at this point.
Well, for the takeaway, it's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. This is political theater you can only dream of. But a GOP endgame for Trump? doubtful, he says.
Absolutely remarkable, historic in every way. You've never seen anything like it. The past nominee of the Republican Party, as you said, doing his very best to help in the 11th hour attempted takedown of the person who is now the presumptive nominee, not the nominee yet, but the presumptive nominee of his party, all against a backdrop, John, of 7 years of the Republican establishment courting the exact anger, the exact vehemence that Donald Trump has come to represent. Part of the irony of Mitt Romney being on that stage and delivering such a powerful indictment of Donald Trump is how Mitt Romney helped to court and create the phenomenon that is Donald Trump, and he made absolutely no acknowledgement of it. Some of this has to do with raising money from Wall Street donors to put up ads. It has to do with getting respected establishment, well-known, high-name ID politicians out in front of the public like Mitt Romney that you just saw. But the organization really stops there because, John, where does the organization go when the field against Donald Trump is still split as it is, when Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and for that matter, John Kasich, are still fighting each other for the right to challenge Trump directly? All of the talk, all of the speeches, and all of the money raised don't make a bit of difference if Trump goes into that convention with a majority of delegates. And if he goes into the convention on the cusp of a majority of delegates, you have the added liability of trying to unseat the person who won the majority of the Republican primary and stick a thumb into the eye of millions and millions of Republican voters who want Trump. There's no good way out of this.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
And that's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry. This week, a state House committee voted to allow a new type of consumer loan into Arizona. Voters 8 years ago voted to kill off the payday loan industry, and current state law generally allows interest rates up to 36% a year. Senate Bill 1316 would allow lenders to charge up to 17% a month on loans up to $2,500 for up to 2 years. State Representative J.D. Mesnard says it's about consumer choice.
When we prohibit people from making decisions, that's exactly what we're saying, that we know better than they do. I resist that. Does it mean if given the choice that people will make bad decisions sometimes? Yes, it does. But you don't remove the choice from everybody because of those who will make bad decisions.
The House Ways and Means Committee has approved the bill, which now awaits debate by the full chamber. One person opposed to the proposal is Catherine Scrivano, a financial planner with Casco Financial Group in Phoenix. And Catherine, you believe these kinds of loans tend to negatively impact women more than men. Is that right?
I'm absolutely positive that's true. The typical flex loan user or payday loan user, the person who does that kind of borrowing, is typically female, between the ages of 25 and 44. And contrary to the way they are promoted, people are borrowing to pay living expenses. They are not borrowing in reaction to emergencies.
And why does that affect women more than men? I mean, it seems like both genders would have to pay those kinds of living expenses.
Oh, absolutely. But typically, women are the caretakers. Women are caring for families, for children, often on their own. Typically, women are paid less than men, so they are more likely to need some help stretching the dollar. We're living in circumstances right now where benefits are being cut, access to resources are being cut, and it frustrates me that the Arizona legislature is actually considering something that would potentially harm families.
Yes, yeah, so I'm curious about whether you think this Senate Bill 1316, these new consumer flex loans, as you call them, if that is any better for folks and specifically women than what we traditionally think of as a quote unquote payday loan.
There's very little difference. The differences are so subtle that I frankly don't think they're going to mean anything.
What do you make of the argument that supporters of this bill and this kind of business make, which is that sometimes people just don't have any other options, and in the absence of any other options, even what might not be a great loan is something that can help people get by for a short period of time?
And, you know, I'm glad you say this because I don't want to appear unsympathetic. Believe me, I'm very sympathetic. In other states, I think Colorado has made some adjustments to the way that they regulate the payday lending. And at a certain point, these loans become not just two-week loans, but they become more traditional loans. So we're talking about those who are unbanked having options, but not being burdened forever. The Pew Charitable Trust has done a great job of researching this whole issue, and they find that when polled after the fact, a lot of users say that the way they ended up paying off the loan was an option that they really had in the beginning, which was to borrow from family or friends, sell possessions, reduce expenses. I mean, it's again, without judgment, those who had those options in the first place and didn't want to take them ended up taking them.
So it sounds like you don't really buy into that argument that for some people, this is the only option and it should be an option. If people choose to take it, that's fine. If people choose, if they don't like it or choose not to take it, they don't have to do it.
I don't necessarily want to cut off all options, but I would like to see if we're going to have anything like payday or flex loans, that they be more consumer friendly. So I'm asking our legislature to not have a double whammy in creating a way for folks to just stop the pain short term, but in the end, again, have to face the pain.
Catherine Scrivano is a financial planner with Casco Financial here in Phoenix. Catherine, thank you so much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
A national campaign to end juvenile incarceration called Youth First launched an effort today to close the country's youth prisons. Liz Ryan, president of Youth First, announced the campaign on a conference call this morning.
On any given day in the United States, 54,000 young people are incarcerated in youth prisons or confined in out-of-home placements in the juvenile justice system. States still rely on youth prisons, even though research consistently shows that incarcerating youth isn't safe, isn't fair, and doesn't work.
Youth First says rates of incarceration show a bias against minorities and claims locking up young offenders exposes them to violence, unsafe conditions, and increases their chances of ending up back behind bars.
Youth who've been incarcerated in youth prisons experience high recidivism rates, and this substantially increases the likelihood that they will be incarcerated in the adult criminal justice system.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joins me with some local perspective on this issue. So, Jimmy, do we have any youth prisons in Arizona?
We do, Mark. Just one. It's called the Adobe Mountain School. It's located on 300 acres here in Phoenix and consists of about 40 buildings, some of which are more than 40 years old. It has a capacity for about 650 children, but it currently holds a little more than 200. I spoke with Donna Marie Markley. She's the agency head at the Arizona Department of Juvenile Corrections, which runs the Adobe Mountain School. She defends conditions at the prison. She told me the state is working to put more money into newer facilities and says the children confined there have access to quality programs and rehabilitative care.
We provide the children with an education. Last year, we issued over 80 high school diplomas. We have our own health system at the facility, doctors, dentists, medical personnel, nurses, psychiatrists. We have a complete clinical program with psychiatrists, psychologists, psych associates.
Markley says they're also extensively audited and are in full compliance with state and federal agencies that inspect the facility on a regular basis.
How old are the kids that are being held there?
Well, they're between the ages of 14 and 17, and their average stay in prison is about 7 months.
Okay, but even if it's a safe, secure facility, it sounds like Youth First is arguing the actual act of confinement has an adverse effect on kids.
Well, that's right, and the state seems to be on the same page with advocacy groups on this point. Everyone acknowledges that for the most part, kids get better treatment when they're dealt with at a local level in their community. So the Department of Juvenile Corrections is actually working to reduce their numbers of children held in confinement at the Adobe Mountain School. Markley says the state only directs the most serious youth offenders to the prison.
So these are youth that have felony convictions, typically multiple felony convictions. Many of those are property crimes, crimes against persons, drug offenses, weapons violations.
She also says a quarter of the children there have been convicted of sex offenses. While many of them had the opportunity to have their criminal records destroyed, often what we see is many of these children going back to jail as adults.
Right, this issue of recidivism.
Yeah, the Children's Action Alliance is a group that advocates for juvenile justice reform. I spoke with one of their directors, Beth Rosenberg, and she told me they estimate the recidivism rate for children that have been in the Adobe Mountain School is 46%. So again, they're advocating advocating that children be treated at the county level by the county juvenile courts and their corresponding programs. Here's Rosenberg.
The youth are closer to home, and you can work with their families, and they can be kept in the school program close to home. And we know that the outcomes for youth are also better, and public safety is better for youth when they are treated in their home location.
So what about the cost for all of this, Jimmy? Is it cheaper to treat these young offenders at the state or at the local level?
It's much cheaper to treat them at the local level. For a child that spends 7 or 8 months at the Adobe Mountain School, the cost can be more than $80,000, you know, because it's not just the cost of programming, it's also the housing and the medical costs the state has to pay for. But last year, funding for the Juvenile Corrections Department changed. It used to be totally state-appropriated money, but now the counties are required to contribute a total of $12 million to the budget, which, as Rosenberg explains, has changed treatment incentives.
We basically told the counties that we're not going to give you more money for community-based treatment services, but we want you to support secure facilities, which is not based on the number of kids that are being sent to juvenile corrections from the county. It's based on the total county population. So even if counties are doing well and they're keeping youth in their communities and the public safety is still maintained, those counties are being charged for supporting a secure facility that might not provide the best public safety or youth outcomes for the state.
So, Mark, the state and these advocacy groups are in agreement that better outcomes are generated at the local level, but funding those programs is an ongoing challenge.
That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Mark.
Identity theft complaints are on the rise. Almost 500,000 people filed complaints with the Federal Trade Commission last year about identity theft. That represents a 47% increase in ID theft complaints since the year before. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger dug into these numbers for us. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Mark.
So where does Arizona stand in all of this?
Arizona came in toward the top of the list, actually, at number 14, which is actually a lot better than we've done in the past. I talked with Mark Pribish about this. He's vice president and ID theft practice manager with Merchants Information Solutions in Phoenix, and he helps companies manage data breaches. He said until recently, Arizona was number one on the list for 5 years running.
What makes Arizonans more susceptible to identity theft?
Well, Pribish said there are a few reasons for this, but mostly he thinks it's because of one thing.
Well, I think we're a very transient state. So I'm from New Jersey, and I grew up on a street 5 miles long, 10 houses. Seven of those 10 houses are my aunts and uncles, 26 first cousins. Most of those people have never left New Jersey and the houses that they grew up in. But Arizona is a very transient state. And we have a lot of people coming and going. Mm-hmm. And when you have a lot of people coming and going, it's one thing to physically move our furniture and our valuables. But when we move, we're also transferring your and my personal information. And when our personal information is being transferred to the new doctor, the new dentist, your new home and auto insurance agent, every time you start a new relationship, you are ending a relationship and trusting your former home and auto insurance agent that the name and social security number that he or she has on all family members is going to be safe and secure.
That's why he says it's important to change passwords, avoid phishing emails, and avoid oversharing on social media.
Lauren, what about these big data breaches we keep hearing about?
So Pribish says those are not the reason most of us will have our identities stolen.
The big part is because of the information we are sharing with our employers, our doctors, our home and auto insurance agent, our dentist, our tax preparation service providers, our banks. Our information is out there. And when we make changes, when we change providers, when we move, we are adding a new database to new relationships. But what about all the old relationships and how safe and secure is that information?
He says that's why we see ID theft among young people whose parents share their information with employer after employer over the years. And when we think about identity theft, we usually think about getting our credit card number stolen. But actually, the FTC found that in 2015, only 25% of all ID theft is financial.
The number one reason is what we call taxpayer ID theft and refund fraud. And it's no coincidence, 7, 8 years ago, most consumers in the U.S. started filing their taxes online. At the encouragement and recommendation of the U.S. federal government, the Treasury, and whether you're using a tax preparation service or doing it yourself, the online tax preparation has been a contributor to what we call taxpayer ID theft and refund fraud.
And you don't even have to be expecting a refund to become a victim of tax fraud like this. But if you are waiting for that refund check and someone files their taxes as you, Pribish says it's your responsibility to prove who you are, and it could take up to a year for you to resolve it.
That's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Mark.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, my name is Lynn. I'm out here at the Mesa Community College Rose Garden. There are many of us who come out here on the weekends. We are called deadheaders. We're cutting right above a new growth, a new bud. It gives it new verb, gives it new reason for growing.
We cut at a little bit of an angle with the bud eye just above.
Okay. These things are so happy to get attention that it's just fun to work in them. Now it looks like it's had a haircut. Then at the end of March, it will be ablaze, just ablaze with color.
That's Lynn Twitchell tending the rose bushes at the Mesa Community College Rose Garden. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just think we're a little thorny, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
There's been a lot of talk at the Capitol this year about the state's Empowerment Scholarship Account program, efforts to expand it to allow any student in Arizona to use public money to attend a private school have faced opposition. At the same time, the Grand Canyon Institute has been looking into another aspect of the private versus public education debate, the state's tuition tax credit program. Dave Wells is the Institute's research director, and he joins me. So, Dave, as a foundation, is it right that enrollment at private schools in Arizona is down?
Right. And I had to create an estimate for 2013-2014 based on the schools that reported and the ones that didn't report. But yeah, we've seen a sort of a long-term trend in the United States where it's been declining. And in Arizona, it only increased a little bit in the early 2000s and has been back to going down.
Is Arizona's decline sort of in line with the national one?
Overall, if you look over 20 years, it's actually a bit faster than the national one. That's largely probably due to charter schools because we have the most charter schools per capita than any other state.
So what's the relationship there between private schools and charter schools? Is it just a matter of parents not wanting to pay for a private school, then go to a charter school and not pay?
Well, initially, that was the case, right? Charter schools, and in fact, a number of private schools became charter schools when they were first started in the late 1990s. And so, yes, and there are also so many of them. There are 500-some charter schools out there. There are about 300 private schools, but a lot of the private schools are puny, like 20 students and something like that. So it became more closer to them because transportation is a big deal, and so charter schools are a pretty good substitute for a lot of private schools.
So if there is a decrease in the number of students going to private schools and an increase in the number of students going to charter schools, what does that mean for the state's fiscal situation?
Well, what I've calculated is essentially we provide a lot of scholarship money to private schools now. It's proliferated, and we now actually have more scholarships than there actually are students, and which is something we don't track. But now it's clearly obvious that many students are getting multiple scholarships. So it's really not a cost issue anymore. But in terms of the general fund, when you try to control for the fact that charters actually decrease private school enrollment and the scholarships are supposed to increase it, I was able to estimate that it's costing us about $10,000 per added student into private schools.
$10,000 per student who goes to a private school who would otherwise go to a district school or a charter school.
That's correct.
When you talk about the cost of private school students, is that a reflection of the amount of money that folks can deduct from their Arizona income taxes when they donate to school tuition organizations?
Well, that's certainly one of the factors. That keeps expanding, and currently there are two different programs for individuals, and so that an individual now through those two programs could contribute up to $1,000 and a couple up to about $2,000 on their taxes, and it's a dollar for dollar deduction if they give that money to a scholarship tuition organization. Now, the flip side is corporate tax deductions are going up 20% per year, and that is currently now now up to about $62 million in the next fiscal year.
Should we be less concerned about that $10,000 figure, given that there are fewer students in private schools than there used to be?
Well, the cost of these credits has now gone up to $140 million in the last and it's spent. I mean, it's not all spent right away. That's a significant amount of money. We think we cut universities by almost $100 million last year. So $140 million, I mean, it's not a huge amount of money compared to what we spend on public schools. But given the tight budget situations that we have, lawmakers really need to be thoughtful about the idea about where money is going and whether it's cost effective.
Dave Wells is the research director at the Grand Canyon Institute. Dave, thank you.
Thank you.
The push is on to recognize that not every student has to graduate with a bachelor's degree to be a productive worker and a member of the middle class economically, and that has increased the focus on career and technical education and the potential impact on students who aren't interested in what's been the conventional higher ed path. Those are some of the issues Bill Simons is especially energized by. Simons is director of the Global Pathways Institute and professor of practice at ASU, and he joins me now. Bill, what are you seeing and hearing from other professionals about career and technical education?
I think many people don't realize that the majority of jobs in Arizona today and looking forward do not require a four-year college degree. What they do require is advanced technical skills that students can learn and master both at the high school level at our JTEDs and in post-secondary education at our community colleges.
How important was the legislative act and Governor Ducey going ahead and signing the money that had been taken out of JTED programs, the fact that that is now back in the mix?
That was an incredibly important action. We've rarely seen action like that in Arizona, where a governor presents a budget and then just a few weeks later signs a new proposal that restores funding that he didn't call for in his budget. And that's the result of overwhelming support from the Arizona business community, not to mention educators and many others concerned about the future welfare of our students in Arizona.
Are we seeing more momentum for this sort of career and technical education leading to jobs? Did that take a while for people to figure out?
Well, I think we are seeing more momentum, but we have a long way to go. I think it's worth pointing out that last year, Nevada voted to triple spending on CTE. One reason for that is that Nevada beat out Arizona for the Tesla battery plant, which is going to bring many jobs to the state of Nevada. Denver Public Schools is making a major investment to dramatically increase the number of students on career pathways. What the legislature did was to hold JTED funding constant at where it's been. Meanwhile, the states with which we're competing are dramatically increasing their investments in this form of education.
So, Bill, does it take landing a major project like that to really put it in bright lights to people that that's what we need? Or are there other methods to getting lawmakers, business officials, and whatnot, people who are really the movers and shakers, to realize the value of this?
The reality is that right now we're not successfully preparing many young people for career success. And if we expanded these programs like the JTEDs and also community college offerings, we could go a long way toward equipping more young people to get good jobs, earn a solid living, and really achieve economic independence.
Where are you seeing the potential for more hands-on kind of employment?
Healthcare is a great example. Most nurses and technicians are working with their hands. If you're looking at hospitality, we need chefs, we need people working in our hotels and resorts. That's a major industry in Arizona. They're all working with their hands in one form or another. If we look at auto and diesel truck repair and maintenance, those are very hands-on jobs, and dealers are constantly complaining. They're struggling to fill those jobs, even though they pay more than what the average Arizonan earns. So these are not bad jobs. These are great jobs.
We hear about the crumbling middle class. Is developing this sort of thing a way to reverse that trend?
Yes, Steve, I think that's a critical answer. You know, the problem we've adopted in our society is we've taken a very elitist view towards both education and the workforce. So students are told if they want to be successful, they need to go to a four-year university. At the same time, we look down on jobs that don't require the four-year degree. And we're saying those are somehow second-class jobs if you're working in construction or if you're working in hospitality. The reality is that we had many middle-class jobs. Most people didn't go to college. They still achieved economic success. We have to get back to the idea of valuing the dignity of work and recognize that many of these jobs do offer a solid middle-class standard of living. So we have to change the way we look at the workforce.
Bill Simons, director of the Global Pathways Institute and professor of practice at ASU, We've been talking about advances in career and technical education.
Phoenix recently rolled out a new program aimed at helping homeowners associations get a handle on how much water they're using in common areas and to help them use less. The HOA Water Efficiency Program started as a pilot project last summer in response to demand from HOAs. Tina Sleeper is a water conservation specialist with the City of Phoenix.
There are a lot of homeowners associations that have control over common areas, and they have a lot that they need to pay for, and they just need a lot of help to see if they're being efficient with their water use, because it also reflects in the beauty of their landscape as well. And so our program basically is an educational program that we actually measure the square footage of the HOA's common areas, any area that they're paying to water and to care for. And then we put it into a calculator that uses that estimates how much water that landscape should be using. And then we compare it, because we're the water department, we can actually compare it to the amount of water they're really using. And we use that information to kind of help educate the HOAs on their potential to increase their water efficiency.
Does it seem like for HOAs that approach the city and take part in this program that they're using a lot of water on landscaping as opposed to other types of things that people use water on?
Yes, and this isn't really a new idea for a program. In fact, some of my colleagues in other cities, such as Glendale, Gilbert, Scottsdale, they have HOA water efficiency programs that are similar. And that's because the common areas and the landscape is such a huge part of their budget, and it does take so much water, because depending on, you know, how big the HOA is and how big their landscape is, and that's why we focus on it quite a bit.
Do you have a sense of how much water could be saved by HOAs trimming back their use a little bit in common areas?
It really depends on the HOA itself. We've seen a lot of, just from the few HOAs we've worked with, right now it's only been seven, but even learning from my colleagues, we've seen a lot of potential just in making their existing landscape more efficient. But there's also more and more interest in converting areas that aren't being used by the residents to more of a desert landscape, a xeriscape, you know, an Arizona-friendly landscape. And so there's a lot of potential there as well. But just starting with the question of, you know, are they changing the frequency of their watering? Are they actually providing the amount of water the plants need, or are they overwatering? Like, that question itself can also save a lot of water for these HOAs.
In the overall scheme of water usage in Phoenix, when you look at businesses and individuals and other types of institutions, schools, government buildings, all that, where do HOAs fall in terms of the amount of water that they use?
Well, I can say this. Today, our residential water users are really using the most water. And so a lot of our programs focus on educating the everyday common residential homeowner who has to figure out landscape watering, who has to figure out, you know, updating all those fixtures inside the home that use water.
Does the city have an overall goal for this program as far as either participation or overall amount of water that could ultimately be saved?
We don't have a specific goal in terms of reducing a certain percentage of water use or anything like that. Our goal is really to help HOAs identify whether or not they could become much more water efficient and look at options for how to do that.
Tina Sleeper is a water conservation specialist with Phoenix. We are talking about the city's new HOA water efficiency program.
The Southwest Wildlife Conservation Center has more than 200 animals and an increasing number of human neighbors as the area develops.
Last summer, one neighbor sued the center over the noise, among other complaints, and this week the issue has gotten more social media and news attention. The show's Annika Klein looks at what's going on.
The neighborhood is tucked between McDowell Mountain Regional Park and the west side of Tonto National Forest. It's county land. A dirt road takes me past new homes and out to the Wildlife Center, where Executive Director Linda Searles is going through her morning routine.
Gosh, our closest neighbors were a quarter of a mile away, and we only had one when we first moved out here.
That was 22 years ago. The neighborhood has changed, and the center has grown, too.
Kitty, 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 kitty,
It cares for rescue animals, all with a different backstory.
From skunks to ringtails to coatis to raccoons, all the way up to bears and mountain lions.
Almost all are animals you'd find on the land surrounding this place. Seth Gortler, the neighbor who is suing the center, says the reason he moved out here in 2012 was to be closer to nature. The problem, he says, is the noise from the coyotes and wolves. He declined to speak to KJZZ in a recorded interview, but sent a written statement. He says, quote, "This isn't animal sounds off in the distance that I can shut out behind closed doors. This is right next to me. It sounds like I'm living inside a dog kennel," end quote. The center has about 40 wolves and coyotes. Gortler says he visited the center during the day before buying his house, but he realized the problem happens at night. He says that's when the howling is the worst. He argues it's a violation of the county noise ordinance. But Searles, who lives on the center property, says the howling and barking is not that bad.
When they do howl, it's like 60 seconds, and then it's over. It's not very long.
Gortler has another complaint, the tours. Searles says they average about 5,000 visitors a year, mostly school kids.
Pretty much had people come in almost every day but Sunday. And we had a lot of school groups, so we'd have buses in with school kids to do programs. We had summer camps during the summer.
Gortler's objection here is the dust on the road from the vehicles, which Searles says they'll address with a water truck. In the meantime, the tours have been mostly suspended because the center didn't have the proper permit to hold public events. Darren Gerard is with the Maricopa County Planning and Development Department.
The county zoning concern at this point is that any public assembly on the site have some type of temporary use permit specific for that event, or they obtain a special use permit which would allow for the ongoing public assembly at their private wildlife reservation.
The center plans to apply for a special use permit, and with that, the tours and camps can start again, which Searles says are key to raising awareness about the center. That leaves the noise as the final major issue. Gortler says he doesn't want the whole center to go. He says, quote, "The only problem is the coyotes and wolves. People must think I'm some Grinch that can't stand even the distant howl of wildlife," end quote. But Searles says she doesn't plan on moving the coyotes or wolves, and that she doesn't know where they could go.
There's few places for wildlife to go. Most veterinary hospitals will not see wildlife, so they have no alternative, and we're it.
But their neighbor doesn't want to go either. With that, they're stuck at an impasse until the eventual result of the lawsuit. For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
Last month, an autonomous car developed by Google got into an accident with a bus in California. The car was going about 2 miles an hour and nobody was hurt in the incident. But safety concerns are one of the biggest reasons a majority of respondents in recent surveys say they're not comfortable with the idea of a car taking control of its own wheel. Even still, research on autonomous vehicles continues, including in Arizona. That's what it sounds like in the trunk of an autonomous Ford Fusion Hybrid, a third-generation autonomous car. The company parked one in downtown Phoenix this week. Jim McBride was there too. He's technical leader for autonomous vehicles at Ford Motor Company. He's been testing driverless cars since 2005, and I asked him what he's learned by testing in Arizona as opposed to other locations, including closer to home.
When I left Michigan, it was freezing rain and snow, so obviously the weather is different, and we love the sunny weather. But more to the point, if you want a vehicle to be really robust, you have to test it in environments all around the country and the world for that matter. The rules of the road are different everywhere. The sort of topography you'll see is different, and we have to make sure the vehicle can safely drive through all of those environments.
Ford, as well as lots of other companies, do a lot of vehicle testing out here. Is there anything specific that you learn about autonomous vehicles in Arizona that you might not have to worry about with other cars?
Testing this vehicle, we do the same sort of rigorous engineering discipline we do with any test vehicle or new model vehicle. So I think Arizona is just, testing the system in a completely different environment than Michigan.
When you hear stories about what happened with a Google car in California, do you just sort of cringe and worry that that's going to set your research back a bit?
You know, I can't comment on the Google story. I've only read what you've read in the news, and I'm not part of that team. You know, I can just speak for our team. And when we do our testing, we always have two people in the car because for us, safety is the number one issue of importance. And we have an engineer in the back to monitor all the systems and algorithms. We have a safety driver behind the wheel in case we should encounter something that's out of scope.
Irrespective of the specifics of what happened in that particular accident, though, I mean, I would imagine that as somebody who works with autonomous vehicles, you pay attention to what other companies are doing and sort of how their testing is going, especially, I would imagine, as it relates to public perception of your products.
Well, public perception is important, and, you know, with any new technology, you know, you have to educate the public and get them comfortable with it. We went through that same sort of learning curve with anti-lock brakes and airbags, for example. And, you know, rightly so, the public should be expected to be skeptical until they've had a chance to ride in one of these cars. And typically when I get, you know, someone in the car for the first time, within 5 minutes they've forgotten that a computer's driving them around, and their next question is, when can I buy one?
So when you look at polls from AAA and other people that say, you know, large percentages of people aren't comfortable with not being in control behind the wheel, having an autonomous vehicle, to you, is that just a matter of you just have to get more people behind the wheel of one to see what it's really like?
I would say that the polls that you see where people are apprehensive about autonomous vehicle technology are no different than the polls you saw, you know, with airbags or anti-lock brakes. And in those cases, once people got an opportunity to experience the feature, they, you know, they ended up loving it. And the same has been true for anyone that's ridden in our car.
In your mind, when do you expect to see cars like this on the road?
You know, the question that I think is more appropriate is to ask when the underlying technology will be available. And at Ford and in the industry, sort of as a consensus, the answer would be 4 to 5 years. Now, when you actually see a product, it would depend on what the product is. It could range anything from a mobility solution in a closed-off space to a private ownership model. And each of those has its own development cycle plan time.
Jim McBride is technical leader for autonomous vehicles at Ford Motor Company. We are talking about the testing going on in Arizona of the autonomous Ford Fusion Hybrid.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.